Thank you so much, Lyndall and Shelley-Ann. What an incredible achievement and a super step forward for equality in the ACT. I'd like to just invite our panel members to come up and join the stage. And I'd also like to welcome Professor Sandy Wong, who's joining us for the panel and will be here tomorrow for a number of sessions. And Professor Wong is a doctor of... I've got to get the right... Doctor of Philosophy in Early Childhood and is the Co-Deputy Director of the Centre for Research in Early Childhood at Macquarie School of Education. Professor Wong has worked as an academic, a manager, researcher, evaluator, educator, consultant and a nurse within a range of early childhood, academic and health organisations. And Sandy, as I mentioned this morning, Sandy's conducted a lot of research into the realm of early childhood and workforce. So please welcome everybody to the stage.
All right, well, actually, if you'd like to pass the mic on to Lyndall, I'll direct this one. How will ECET registration benefit the ECEC sector as a whole?
So I guess, you know, just to recap what I said in my presentation, I think it is about that professional recognition. It is about saying that the voices of primary and secondary and even tertiary study and teaching, of course it's important. We want people to be lifelong learners and we want to support them on their lifelong learning journey. But the foundations that are built in the early childhood years are so incredibly critical and important. And again, sometimes it feels like shouting into the dark void, but we need to continue with our messaging about the importance of early childhood teaching and about the importance of early childhood education and care, and about, you know, the work that does happen in there. And sometimes it's hard, I think, to help families, to help the community, to understand what it is we do, and that probably is something that we need to get better at. We need to get better at explaining to our community what it is we do and how we do it well, what it looks like, and to be able to celebrate those amazing stories. So, you know, with my CEO hat on as the CEO of TQI, that's what I want to be able to do, is to share the stories of amazing early childhood education and care and to be able to build that understanding across the community. And, you know, I guess my unofficial personal point of view is that at some point that gets recognised in wages and conditions for everybody across the ECEC sector. Thank you.
Well, I was kind of thinking of my very first year and what it was kind of like for me, and then maybe 3 years down the track and 5 years down the track, and what difference that made. I guess, you know, I built on my own skills, my own knowledge, as I can refine some skills as well. We're building on best practice there, and I think we should be at a place for a little bit longer. You understand maybe the courses and procedures that the students have, and know those really well, and you come to recognize the values and maybe expectations of families really well, so you can really meet the needs of the children better.
I think at a centre level, the ECTs and the leadership can drive the knowledge and the professionalism of the entire centre, which in turn delivers a good service to other types of education, care to children and their families.
So I think having that retention also adds to a positive work culture. You have structures and procedures which are embedded. I think when you bring in new colleagues as well into those environments where the staff have been there for a long time, it's easy for those new staff to uptake because there's so much knowledge being shared through that as well.
Okay. Yep. Beautiful. Actually, in Ben and Abby, for you guys, how can specialised skills and knowledge of ECTs help deliver preschool programs and contribute to the overall development and learning outcomes for all children?
How can the professional development?
Yes. Yep. So, yeah.
Well, I guess that it helps them to drive and push themselves. I think it keeps them in their positions. If they're professionally developing, then they tend to keep their passion, their uptake. And I always say, you know, if you're with children, you should be learning with them. So I guess if you're professionally developing with the children and trying to bring those skills into the workplace, outside and in, then you're going to have, I think, a bit more job satisfaction, and it's also going to push you to stay in those roles for a long period of time, which is all about the workplace retention, which again leads into quality, which is what we want.
You and your educators sort of engaging in research and doing that in partnership with the families. I think the more ECTs and educators are engaging in that, like you said, definitely job satisfaction and constant learning, but it also positions you as a professional within the sector that you can advocate for the practice and the pedagogy that is happening at your service with your community. And making sure that they have that buy-in and that partnership as well, which, of course, be sharing with your educators, that you're mentoring and coaching along the way.
Sorry. Thank you. All right, so I do have a question that's coming from the audience, so thank you. And if you do have questions, send them through, QR code. So in this one, I'll open up to whoever would like to take it. Are educators with English as a second language disadvantaged when studying to be an ECT? And is the language test too difficult? And how can we support them?
I think the more educators we have from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, the better. Our clients are diverse, our sector is diverse. One of the challenges in our sector is we don't actually count how many teachers and educators are from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds. But certainly, so here's an example of somebody who's doing study. I've got a PhD student who's a centre director from culturally and linguistically diverse background, and that's her area of research. She wants to know how how you can be a cold director, and the benefits that that brings. And so the first part of her research was to say, well, how many directors? Because what she thought is that a lot of cold educators are kind of stuck at the educator level and are not being promoted. And when we tried to find out the information, there was very little information. It's not collected in census, and if anybody knows where that information is, I'd be very interested to see it, because we couldn't find it. But certainly, in terms of the English language test, having two languages is an advantage, and so we've got to look at things from an advantage perspective. Understanding children, you may have families that are from the same language background. The challenge comes when you're potentially the only person in the service. So often educators, teachers will be attracted to services where there are other culturally linguistically diverse people from their own language background. In terms of the language test, it is challenging and some people do fail it multiple times. There are lots of supports to help people to get over that barrier. Whether or not it's too hard, I can't say, but I think it's essential if you are going to be working with families who's English, who maybe, like me, I can only speak English, that's my bad, but you need to be able to communicate effectively around children and very complex issues with families. So the work you do is very complex, so you actually do need to have a high standard of English to be able to do that work. So yes, it is tricky, it can be a barrier for some students, but it's critical.
Thank you.
So if I can just add, in terms of teacher registration, there is some national work occurring around At the moment for teacher registration, we accept two tests, the ISLBR and the IELTS. There's a bit of a change in how they can be taken and how resets can occur for those. And then there's also a piece of work that's happening in Victoria around looking at a possible an additional English language test that is teacher focused. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens out of that research.
Beautiful. Oh, hey, Dana.
So I was 10 when we migrated to Australia, and my mum was assistant dean at the University of the Philippines. So she was a teacher her whole life, she became a teacher. And we've come here in 1991, and she ended up, she worked at UCE and then ended up, her career was at CIT teaching. And it was interesting that, you know, 20, 30 years later, we're still coming across the same stuff. And what I guess I would offer, again, is meeting people where they are. So often with our participants and the people that we have supported, there were support mechanisms and additional one-on-one tutoring, but people just didn't know it existed. It was on the uni website, the Where on the uni website. So again, I think that's where, whether it is an advocate or someone within your educational leader within the service, or a coach or something like that. And sometimes what we found, people may not feel confident asking this in front of a big trip, but they'd be more than happy to do it before or after. So I guess, you know, again, thinking outside the box, and it may take a little bit longer, but we're talking about people with a lot of experience. And again, yeah, it's about diversity and, you know, people that we also know have gone through have struggled with the language test, so it's actually not that. So, and you know, just again acknowledging people where they are, and that is the value, and you are someone that we are going to invest in, and providing that support. So,
beautiful. And just given the current workforce pressures, what simple steps can providers and services take to support staff wellbeing? So maybe PJ and Helen?
Look, I think again, we're back to culture. So I love it when all that, like, when I started to realize I don't even have a cert three, and they're like, what? And I said, but you know, that's not my job. I'm here to support you. So my undergrad was actually in psychology. And it's about making people feel it's okay to reach out and they don't have to do it on their own. We do have EAP, we have activities, we have that sort of support, but I think it's about, it doesn't matter where you are in the organisation, if you feel like, you know, that people do have time for you, we do staff meetings, and often because we are open for so long and people do such long trips, we do become each other's support networks as well. And I think that's really important. And knowing that everyone has different needs, I think so, making sure that people feel valued.
I think adding on that is creating that safe culture where you do feel comfortable to articulate that, you know, maybe they are struggling. And finding the people who within the service or whoever it is, support people that you can go to talk it out. Yeah.
Okay. And so this question is also
Three, 4 years ago, nobody was talking about educator wellbeing. Literally, when myself and my colleagues who were interested in doing research, and I'll tell you why tomorrow, we said, we're looking at educator wellbeing. They literally, people would say to us, why do you mean the children? We look at children's wellbeing. No, we look at educators' wellbeing. Why are you looking at educators' wellbeing? We have come an enormous way in the last probably 3-4 years. A lot of that is to do with the challenges that we face through COVID, but the fact that we're even talking about it, I think is brilliant. You're already doing some of the stuff to kind of consider a childhood educator will be, and I'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow.
Thank you.
What Hardy mentioned in our presentation, as a service layer, I think it's communicating to also retain that it's okay, we all have these moments where we struggle, and not making them feel bad about it. Like I've heard of educators, you know, who are sick and forced to do things like that, or they're having a rough day and they just, they're made to feel guilty about it. So I think as a service leader, that's something that we can take.
So we see in our roles, when we go into services, a lot of it comes down to the well-being of educators as well. And so one thing we've found that when once we listen to them, and we get down to it, that there is a lot of well-being issues going on amongst teachers, and without that well-being being looked after, the quality is not there. So for us, that they're intrinsically together. So just listen to what we need to do.
Beautiful. Okay, and this question is also for Helen and PJ. So do ECTs in your services usually work the same hours and number of weeks per year as other educators? For example, are they different conditions? Are they working maybe shorter days, 9 to 3? Do they have additional leaves, maybe only working a 40 weeks per year? Does that look different for you?
Most of our ECTs work exactly the same hours. We do have flexible communication. So some educators in young children, for example, we do kind of change shifts and things like that, but most of the work is the same. The probably the difference in terms of annually, we try to see the
also the same. Not 6 weeks. No. I would say that we provide the same flexibility to everyone. So again, it depends where they need to be. So we do have flexible work arrangements. We have a lot of part timers. I think there's really only a handful of all us that work full time. So out of 60 staff, half of that are on our cable pool. I think there's only 10 or 15 of us that work full time. Everyone else is part time because they're either doing further studies or they choose to work 3 or 4 days a week. So, again, it's and Benny, you mentioned earlier, does an incredible job with the rostering. With our ECTs, we do have an enterprise bargaining agreement, sorry, for all the staff. And the most recent iteration, which got approved by Fair Work in April, it does now include the Teachers Award. So we have given our ECTs the choice. So our staff that are employed in the Children's Services Award have above award wage, so we're on 11% and there's like an increment above award, or they can choose to be on the ECT, on the Teachers Award. So again, it's about the choice and then they choose what suits them. And then that's what we base the contract on. So in terms of ours, again, it's just not, that's our own work mind to break. Maybe we'll get to that, but at the moment, especially the ones that are still completing their degrees, it actually, they prefer to have the longer days, and then they can put all their tutorials and lectures all on the same day. So yeah, just
flexible
with that.
Beautiful, thank you. And this question I'll open up for everybody. So the services that have succeeded with ECT retention use models that are potentially unsustainable for many services. How might these be implemented more widely? The services that have succeeded with ECT retention use models that are unsustainable for many services.
What are these unsustainable models? So this is a question from the audience. There might be ways that you're doing things that might not necessarily be a way that another service might do that. So I guess it's for the audience to be open-minded and to consider where their sort of boundaries are and what they can do that fits in with their...
Yeah, this is one of my boys, they're like, Mom, stop answering my question. I'll try to, I guess, approach it kind of broadly then. I guess, you know, it's... So where we, so Verinda, if I can only speak from our perspective, you know, we've gone through quite a journey. I was talking to Sean on the break, you know, we've had to go through changes, and I think it's pain that you have to go through to get to where you are. You know, we're still ongoing, but actually 5-6 years ago, we had to overhaul our governance. So we actually went, so we're also a not-for-profit. So we went from a parent committee to my position was created, and then we became a skills-based board. It's still voluntary, so we moved to, the constitution was changed. It was very fortunate. We had 3 parent members that were lawyers on the board. And so that's moved. So now we are kind of a hybrid where they get... I think we've only got, maybe we have 3 parents on the board, and it's 3-year terms, and they're voting, and the staff are association members. And then from that, you know, we could look at compliance, and we could make sure that management is supported. And then, you know, so the board's job is to support myself. I support management, management supports the leadership team supports the educators, etc. So I promise there's a point. So I guess if we were to look at how can we try something? I think we can only try something if we feel safe enough to be able to take those risks. And so if you're facing insolvency and the doors are going to shut, you're not going to be able to do, you know, existing professional thing. So you do have to look at what is the domino piece that we need to manage first. And then, but actually that flows on. So if the staff see that the leadership is supported, then they also feel like they can have a voice. Hey, I want this, I think we should do it a different way. And so then it becomes cyclical, and it's an interesting model that we have because the staff are all voting members and families are all voting members. So we call it an interdependence where the board is voted in and the board's job is to serve the association. But actually, and it doesn't mean the board members agree on everything, but I think that's actually the beauty of it. So I don't know if that helps, but then, and we have 3 ECTs on the board, even though they're not all teaching. So again, different career pathways that they've taken. We have people with governance experience, business, running their own consultancies. We've got Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander representation. So the idea is, what does the community need? And then we're like a little hub. So that, and I think that's where we've been able to see what else we can do for the sector. And I guess in terms of the future, if you were to draw it back, maybe you could, you know, go to places like this and see how other people do it. And maybe you don't need to solve the whole thing, but what is just my first step and what is my next step? We also find coaching is really good. So everyone on our leadership team have an external coach, because sometimes the problem that they need to figure out could be about one of us. And you can only do that if you have someone else you can soundboard. So whether there is another management or another approved provider that you feel comfortable enough connecting to and that it is a safe space, I think that's where... you know, the solutions could come, but it's something that we need to meet your needs. So I don't think there's not like a recipe or a manual for it. But certainly if you are open and willing to be okay to reach out, and I would say everyone that I've reached out to have been quite good, and there's something that we can learn from everyone, and then we can then bring that back to our staff and our team. I hope that
answers. That's great, PJ.
I just want to say something a little bit more controversial. I don't think we can stop
stop attrition and keep retention with the current conditions that we have. I think we've been burning up educators and teachers for too many years, and what we're trying to do is catch it up. So if you were going to build an early childhood system today, you would not build what we have in Australia. It's not funded appropriately, we don't have the right terms and conditions for educators. Who ever thought that it is okay for one human to look after four babies? Get put in arm. There's no evidence for that. So you will know that there is evidence that shows that the fewer children you have, the ratio is good, the fewer children you have, but there's no evidence that says 4 is the magic number. There's no evidence that says 11, 12, 14, however many is the magic number. So I think we have to really rethink the conditions under which we provide early childhood education and care. And we can look overseas to some other places where this is being done differently. I was in...
Czech Republic.
About 3 or 4 years ago, and their early childhood teachers only work between 9 and 3. They have programming some of that is taken out for programming. They have master's degrees, and when I went there, they showed me around the facilities, and they showed me they had 2 cooks, they had janitors, they had somebody who came in for the art space. And when I told them that, well, none of our early childhood teachers do the laundry and do the washing up, and if there's no cook, they do the cooking as well, they were completely astounded. So I think we need to advocate for better conditions for educators, because better conditions for educators mean better quality of care for the children as well. And I know many, particularly not-for-profit organisations, because that's the evidence, do invest back in to providing better paying conditions for their educators. But I think we're just tinkering around the edges until we change ratios, until we change group size and things like that, and time for professional reflection. I think we're still going to see bleeding of our early childhood educators out.
You don't even know the question yet.
Pass up to Ben.
No chocolates for you, Luke.
Tables. Okay, so to panel members experienced in coaching and mentoring, what key tools and techniques do you consistently use to build best practice within a service?
I think, at least in our context, the thing that we see as being most powerful is that relational approach. So often we might go into a service that's requested some support, and it might take a couple meetings or a couple conversations or at least a couple, you know, tricky questions to sort of get to the bottom of what might be going on, and that's after maybe an observation and just sitting back and listening. So I think really building that rapport first, and then from there, you know, sort of as we do as teachers, really tailoring things to the need that we're seeing. So understanding that it's not a one-size-fits-all solution, and really being led by what that need might be and what the current situation is, and just being really open, non-judgmental about it, and just understanding that we're there to, you know, be shoulder to shoulder and get our hands dirty too, and try to make some difference and some change, and really, I guess, then stepping back and reflecting together and moving forward. But I think that's sort of the approach that I found to work.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Also, you've got to start with the small things. So with my going is the big thing. You've got to start with small things, address those first, and it could be something like well-being. Because you can't have someone who's going to push these big things into these small things about them all the time. So it could be a larger issue that they see as the issue or the place to start, but really got to get in there get to the bottom, and that starts with the relationship. Because without a relationship in coaching, it's not going to happen. You've got to have a mutual respect and an understanding of the space. So something that we do is go in, get the context first. I always take the attitude that it's like going to someone's house. You've got to get to know them, you've got to see how it works before you can sort of try and adjust anything or try to give advice. So you show respect for practice that's already there and respect for the teacher first, and then build on it from that.
definitely the listening, I agree with that. And I think often educators know the answers, so it's asking the right questions for what works for them, really.
Okay, so this question is for, again, Ben and Abby. Sorry, Ben. Can a child access the three-year-old initiative and the universal preschool at the same time?
I can start to answer this, and then if anyone has further questions, I'd really invite you to see Katie after. So the three-year-old initiative is, I'll just break them down sort of separately. The three-year-old initiative sits separately to three-year-old preschool. They cannot be accessed at the same time because the three-year-old initiative is for that... for families who are experiencing vulnerability or disadvantage. And we understand that's a very loose term, intentionally so, because we understand it doesn't look the same for any two families. They can, however, access other things such as CSP, free preschool, the three-year-old preschools that are in a few ACT public schools, but not at the same time as the three-year-old program, which is for that one day or the 300 hours. For the year. So if you have any questions about if the family might fall into, or which category the family might fall into, please come have a chat with us. As I said, we understand it looks really different for all families, and situations change quickly for families. So if you have any questions, please do.
Okay, and I think we have time for one. Okay, and this will be our last question, and this one will actually go out to everybody, and I'm really excited. This is my favourite question. What's the one piece of advice you would share with early career ECTs?
Okay, so I don't get any affiliation funding for this, but in my previous roles, working with my principal colleagues in schools, burnout is a big issue, and I started doing some research in the space and came across a guy called Dr. Adam Fraser, and he talks about different kinds of recovery that you can do, including micro-recovery. So I guess what I would be saying to early childhood teachers is you're in it for the long haul, you need to look after yourself. The best person to look after you is actually you, and the more skills and knowledge that you have about your own well-being and how to maintain your own well-being, I think the better off you'll be in the long term. So again, it's a psychologist, his name is Dr. Adam Fraser. He does all different kinds of work, but in particular, I love the work that he does around micro-recovery, so I encourage you to have a look at that.
I think I'd like to say for new graduates that they are beginning teachers. Teaching is a craft, and you learn that craft through practice and being embedded in places where there are other experts who you can look at, study them, think about how they talk to that child in that way or talk to that family in another way. And to be kind to themselves and gather around as many people as possible. So recognising that you're just a newbie, you are a novice, and don't have such high expectations of yourself. Like, it's good to have high expectations, but this is really difficult, challenging work, and you learn that craft by gathering others around you and by watching and being in those spaces with those people.
I would actually like to offer that by us investing in the current educators, the people who have been in the sector for 10, 15 years and want to take that next step. You know, these are people who are already invested. So I would say that they're not newbies, but what a further qualifications provide is further depth, you know, analysis, and to add the practical things that they already do and the people skills that they already have. And then I have seen, like, although the team's like, what, another new idea? So it's just another level of depth. And so for that, I don't know if you would call them early careers, but it's taking their next step as well. So that they already know how the profession works, but it means that they can keep developing because we are in education. That's probably the word.
I absolutely agree that the research shows that if we have people who go from Cert 3 to diploma to degree to graduate, they're the ones who are potentially the most committed because they actually know what the sector is about. Whereas those coming into their degrees from school, somebody somewhere has told them, oh, why don't you be an early childhood teacher, it's easy, you want to just play all day with children, or something similar to that. Or they love children, which is a good place to start, but it's never enough, right? So sometimes you get the wrong people coming in, whereas if you do that transition, Cert 3, diploma, degree, yes, they've got all that knowledge, skills, understanding, but still, that step into being the early childhood teacher, to taking on that different role, I think it has to come with new responsibilities. And those people, those graduates who have that background, may actually feel even more intimidated when they go to be the teacher because they're taking on this new extended role. So they still have to be, so my message is still the same, that they still have to be, they're new in this role. Yes, you may have been a diploma for 2 years, but now you're a teacher, and that is different. And I know in early childhood, we all want to say everybody does the same things, we're all equal. That's what we were saying in the 2000s, we're all equal. We shouldn't be. Because if you're an early childhood teacher, you've done a 3 or 4 year degree course. And if that doesn't change you, there's a problem. You as teachers have a different role to play. And then stepping up into this new role, it's a challenge. And you still need to be able to see, well, how am I now going to take all that knowledge, skills, understanding with me into this new role and thinking about how you're different. So I'm not disagreeing with you, I'm just kind of adding an extra kind of thought.
I think spend time watching and listening and learning from everyone that's around you. You need lots of tools, obviously. Every child's different, and to learn different teaching strategies to implement as well. So watch and learn.
Yeah, I agree with that. Everyone's got their own strengths, and just because an educator is certificate 3 qualified, they may have 15 years' experience and there's a lot to learn from that. So yeah, I think take the time to learn from all different things. Not rushing to progress to the next step.
I would say be curious. So question what's happening around. It will not only fill you with confidence if you know why you're doing what you're doing, but it also might unravel some things and people might go, oh, we've been doing this the same way just because we always have. So sort of having that confidence and that understanding of what you're doing, which will enable you to, you know, develop even better practice in some cases and in others just to really, position yourself as a professional and someone who is very confident in their own practice.
So just adding on to all of those wonderful ideas, I'd say don't forget to learn with the children. Mm-hmm. So I always put it as nerding out for the kids, so get out of your comfort zone, if there's something you don't know anything about, that's okay. Time to learn with them. But I think that's one of the most enjoyable things about being a teacher.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your responses. And I'll pass back over to Sean.
Yeah, just another round of applause for that.